McLean Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Heavens to Betsy, have we ever got things to talk about today? You know, it's it's that time of year. It's you walk outside and it's kind of warm even in the mornings. I know it's foggy. For a lot of you, it's foggy. But that's going to burn off and it's going to be quite warm today. Nearly 80 degrees. And you know, you got some tomatoes inside. That's a good sign. It's about time to think about what to do with tomatoes. Should you put your tomatoes out? Absolutely yes. Absolutely no. How do you know the difference? We're going to talk about it. That's going to be on the show today. We're going to take a little bit of time to talk a little bit more about what should be planted out today. It's a really important subject. We don't want to forget about it this week because it's a critical time. I've been looking at the weather. Yeah, there's some good signs and some bad signs. And it depends on where you live. We're going to talk a little bit about that. That's important, too. Boy, I could talk all morning about where you live. You know, I had a little column in today's newspaper. There's this thing called a newspaper. I don't know. Some of you may have forgotten. But it's on paper. They have them in newsstands. They have them in news racks. Some people get them delivered to explain what a newspaper is. And we had in the newspaper, there's a column today in all three newspapers in the state, big newspapers, the biggest ones in Mobile, Huntsville, and Birmingham. And I wrote it. And I said, you know, the state is more than a month tall. It's an interesting thing. And right along the coast, I would say Mobile County is almost 2 weeks tall. It's about 2 weeks tall. And what do I mean by that? I mean more than 2 weeks tall. It means that things that happen in the southern part of the county take 2 weeks later from a garden perspective to happen. 2 weeks or more later to happen in the northern part of the county. So that's one thing we got to think about when we're planting. But you know, the other thing that I'm thinking about today as we're planting is that to do it right, because we're at that time of year, we're not planting stuff inside anymore. I don't think there's as much advantage to planting stuff inside. There's some exceptions. We're outside now. And one interesting thing, and I've been thinking about this a lot more, and it's important to gardeners to think about this. The interesting thing that COVID has taught us is the importance of being outside. I'm serious. COVID should change the way we view being outside. We have created a world up until the time of COVID, where we could live in a spacesuit all the time. The more we lived in a spacesuit, the better off we thought we were. You know, we built a dadgum government building downtown, and everybody's got complaints about the government building for various reasons. My complaint, I only have a couple. And the big one, though, is the fact that it's built like a mall, which was the wrong concept at the time. And the idea is you should never have to leave a covered space. You go from your car. Of course, they didn't make a provision for car parking, but that's okay. It's nice to be outside sometimes. You go from your car to the inside of a building, and all the everything is covered, and everything is enclosed. It's all a spacesuit. Our houses have become spacesuits. We never open the windows. People nail their windows shut. They lock their... I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy how we've lived our lives in these spacesuits. Our offices don't have windows that open. And to be outside is weird. You know, and to be outside ought to be normal. And what's interesting about COVID is that it is making us realize that the one place we're safe from COVID, more than any other place, is outside. It's that simple. Sunlight. Sunlight helps break down the virus. Air, wind currents, movement, air movement, the great space above you that doesn't have a ceiling, that doesn't have sheetrock, is free of COVID. It disperses COVID. And that's really important because there are, as someone pointed out in an article today in The Atlantic, there are no super spreader events, are very few ever, that have been associated with outside events. They've all been associated, almost all of them, if not all, have been associated with inside events. Sheetrock. If you see sheetrock, you're in an area with incredible COVID potential. Get outside. It's time to plant. It's time to, we need the vaccinations, absolutely. We don't want to get into that discussion, I'm sure, but the vaccinations will be great. But the masks are good. They're really good. We don't want to get into that discussion. But here's what I want to talk about. Being outside and how important it is to your health, not just with COVID, but all the time, whether it's your exposure to vitamin D, whether it's just the fact that, you know, even in a flu season, you're not going to transmit flu that well when you're outside. You're always going to be, it's when you're inside, that's when it becomes a problem. Being outside, really nice thing to do, really nice day to do it. Let's get outside in the garden. Let's think about that. You know, one of the other things I want to think about with COVID is not just being outside, but letting the outside in. And this is the time of year to think about letting the outside into your house. You know, if your house smells like it hadn't been open to the outside in a long time, it has a peculiar sort of, you know, like an enclosed smell. It's really nice to let the doors open, put the windows open. And one of the interesting things is that we're finding that in schools, you want to, and this is good scientific basis for this, you want to reduce the incidence of COVID in schools, open the windows. Let the inside out and let the outside in. That's one of the things to do this time of year. It's that time of year. We're going to talk more about that. What if we design buildings to think about that too? What if we, you remember when we used to have church? You remember when we used to have church under an arbor outside? You remember that? Nowadays, we got church in the middle of sheetrock and metal buildings. That's the way we think about it. Spacesuits. Getting inside our spacesuits. Let's get outside today. Hey, so we got to talk about what are we going to do when we get outside? And I'm going to tell you that it's looking ripe. It's looking ripe for planting tomatoes. There's a lot of ins and outs about that. My good friend and great gardening authority, John Olive, who is actually trained in these things and is the guy I always go to with questions about diseases and insect damage, because I know that John is the guy who sorts it out. He's head of the Auburn experiment station here in Mobile. John, I didn't get the name right, but the ornamental, you know, horticultural field station. I'll have to think about it, John. But John is head of that thing, and John's been really good about talking with me about different things. One of the things we talked about is, you know, what is your advice on putting out peppers? And that's a good question, because I'm not sure. It's a little more subtle. It's a little more complicated. So we're going to talk about peppers today, too. But we're going to first talk about tomatoes. And I'm going to tell you, depending on where you live in this state that's more than a month tall, and in the coastal counties, which are more than 2 weeks tall, you'll have to make some decisions about planting right now. And we'll help you do that. You can feel free to give us a call. And we'll talk to you about what's going to happen in your garden. I think I know it probably well enough. I think I know the area well enough that I can make some good guesses about what's going to happen in your garden. And we're talking about planting, because I think some of you are ready to plant. Whoever plants, you got to be prepared, folks. It's going to stay warm, but, you know, there are these little outbreaks of things that are happening with some frequency, and we're going to have to worry about them. We'll be back. We're going to talk a little bit more about that. We're going to talk about your tomatoes. Hey, stay tuned. This is very important.
My girl, don't lie to me.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. The jasmine is touched their word.
Okay, here we are. We're coming back. You know, I'm going to... My computers are not cooperating this morning. I'm going to try to get on Facebook. Oh, there it is. And I'm going to talk to you about, I haven't seen the pictures yet, but I'm told they're pretty cool. And I will talk a little bit more about them when I'm able to access them myself. And that's my fault this morning. But listen, Rob Koss had a picture of daffodils and a bee. And Kevin Harrison had a picture of gardens, of greens. I think I can mention both of them. And there was a little battle between supporters of both as to who had the best picture, photo, on our Facebook page. And it looks like Rob won. Looks like Rob won. So, Rob, daffodils and bee. So, here's what I'm talking about. It's me. Somebody else can tell you better about it. But this thing on Facebook, FM Talk 106.5, you know, we have a kind of a site there on Facebook. And on that site, you can download your pictures of your garden, and we have a contest every week. And the winner of that contest, who got the picture that attracts the most attention on this beauty contest called Facebook, the picture that attracts the most attention gets the prize. And the prize, that's a pretty good one. I'll have to say, it's a useful one. You know, it ain't gold. It ain't stocks. It ain't bonds. It ain't hard cash, but it's pretty good. It's a calendar that helps you to understand when to plant pretty much all along throughout South Alabama, but particularly along the Gulf Coast, where we don't have a lot of information about what to do when. And so it's a really nice thing. And you can do that. Hey, if you have other pictures that you need me to identify right away on the show, you can just text it right away. Don't go through Facebook to do that. You just text me the pictures of the plants, and I can identify them for you. I might be able to tell you what's wrong or what to do. We'll try to do that. So there's our first item of business. But you know, I don't want to tease you too long. I want to make good on this. And we got a lot of questions, and some forbearance here because we got a lot to do today. It's a busy, busy time in the garden. Tomatoes. What are you going to do with them? I mean, they're sitting there looking at you like saying, is it time yet? Is it time yet? You've been keeping me in this little pot. You've been keeping me on the windowsill. You've been taking me out on the porch. Gosh, I hope you took them out on the porch. I hope you didn't leave them under those inside lights. You ain't growing pot here. You're growing tomatoes, and they need to be outside. Excuse me for saying that, but it's true. And it's... they need to be outside on these warm days and enjoying the porch. They're probably out on the porch. If you did it right, they're out on the porch enjoying the porch right now. Is it time to plant tomatoes? Let me say, if you're on Dolphin Island, you need to jump on it. I've been looking at the weather, and I think it's going to stay. I think it's going to stay pretty warm for quite a while now. The 20 somewhere around the 27th, 26, 27, 28, 29. most of the places around Mobile Bay, most of the places close to Mobile Bay, that would include Mobile and Fairhope, certainly Gulf Shores, and certainly Dauphin Island, Fowl River, all those places, the last average frost is somewhere between, oh, I would say February 25 and March 3rd. And so that last average frost is a good date to judge when you should put your tomatoes out. And the reason you want to get them out as soon as possible is not because of what's behind you, not because of the cold, not because of, it's because of what's ahead of you. And what's ahead of you is July and Gulf summer. And when July and Gulf summer gets here, no matter what tomato you have, you're going to have problems with it. It's just not going to, it's going to quit producing. Now, some tomatoes are better, and they're going to surprise you. It's not the ones that they call heat tolerant. The heat tolerant tomatoes, the solar sets and all that, that's for Florida. It's for winter in Florida. I know you think, no, it doesn't help you during summer. You've got to have those tomatoes producing. You want to have your tomatoes producing because our best season for production is May and June. And the earlier in May you can get those tomatoes producing, the better your tomato crop's going to be, the better your tomatoes are going to be. It's classic growing weather. And to do that, you got to get those tomatoes planted early. And I could do the math for you, but you can just look at your varieties and tell you, you know, some of you are probably growing some of them crazy 90-day varieties, and I almost can't help you because, boy, they take way too long. But if you've got a good average 70 or 75-day variety, you just do the math because it's going to be about 70 or 75 days from the time you put it out until the time it produces. So if you put it out the 1st of March, April, it's going to be May 15th, before it's starting to produce a lot of tomatoes. So you want to get it. And so what if it waits till the end of May? Man, what a mess, because then you've only got, see what I'm saying? So you want to get those tomatoes out as soon as possible. As soon as possible. The question is the temperature right? Is the temperature right? I will tell you that the soil temperatures are probably pretty good. We've had enough warmth to we've had enough warm days now to raise the soil temperature. It's probably not quite as high as I would like, but it's probably pretty good. It's okay. So the soil temperature is good. That's very important. That's very important when you're thinking about tomatoes. And I would say the soil temperature is probably pretty good from Citronelle South. The air temperature is another thing. And today, everybody's going to feel like it's a perfect tomato day. I mean, the tomatoes are going to think it's a perfect tomato day. You're going to think it's a perfect tomato day. But that's today. So we've got to think about what's happening in the coming few weeks. And one of the things going to happen, it's going to get a little cooler. We're going to have fewer days in the 70s. We're going to have nighttime temperatures in the 40s. And I think that's probably going to persist for quite a while. I think we're going to be back up into the 70s in another week or two, and that's good. But there's another thing that we have to think about, and that is, what if we get a late frost? And this, no matter, you can't avoid the late frost. I mean, you just can't do it. You can't grow a garden and think, oh, I'm going to. But here's what you can do. You can protect, you can be prepared to protect your tomatoes. And we're going to talk about that. So we're going to talk about putting your tomatoes out today for most of you. North, Citronella North, I'd hold off just a little while. There's no, you got a little more time because you don't have those really hot, consistently hot nights that folks along the Gulf have, right along the Gulf. You can wait a little while. Up around Citronelle, you can wait a little while. If you're in a cooler area, you know, that's a good question. Keith, you might over in Agricola, you might sort of think, well, I'm getting a little cooler nights. I can wait a week. But if you're near the bay, if you're near the coast, I would say today is a great day to put your tomatoes out. Great day to put your tomatoes out. But be prepared. Be prepared for it. North of Citronelle, let's don't do it, folks. Let's wait a while. let's wait on things. You know, if you're up around Florala, up towards Florala, over in that part of off the Florida Panhandle, right up to the Alabama-Florida line, it's a little early there. It's a little early there for a lot of reasons. There'll be more. There'll be later frost. I'd wait on that unless you got special preparations for it. And there's some out there. Let's don't do that. And we'll talk about the special preparations next. So there it is. I hope you're listening. I hope you're paying attention. If I'm not making any sense, you call me and say, you don't make any sense. Tell me what to do in my yard. And we'll help you figure that out. I should talk about peppers. And I could talk about peppers a long time. John Olive and I had a long discussion about it. Should we put our bell peppers out now? Let me say that if you've got habaneros, don't put them out now. If you've got most of the peppers that I recommend, don't put them out now. Wait on them. Bell peppers, maybe another thing. We'll be back. We're going to talk about that.
You can take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown bag for me. Seal right around.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Lots of things to think about and talk about. So Dan's making his case that he's going to hold off. He's still starting his peppers from seed, and so am I. You know, the good thing about the peppers that we talk about a lot on this show. The peppers that do best for us over the long haul, that are really productive, is that they do tend to keep producing through the summer. They don't suffer from the same problems that tomatoes do, and particularly Caribbean peppers from the Caribbean that have a so long association in the Caribbean, and that includes habaneros. It also includes the sweet, non-hot versions of habaneros, like Aji Dulce. Many of the peppers that start with the name AJI, which we recommend a lot, they're really great peppers for us along the Gulf Coast, there's not a lot of need to put them in the ground right away. They will be productive into December. They're very good that way. There'll be a little lull in July and August with some of those peppers. And some of those peppers, like habaneros and Aji Dulces, can take a lot longer to get started. So there's no need to put those in the ground right now. I like to get those in the ground in April because I like peppers. I want to get them. Want to get as many peppers as I can, as quickly as I can, and get them started producing. It takes them a while to sit in the ground, but for those peppers, not now. But listen, if you're growing things like bell peppers and peppers in the annuum group like poblanos. Hear me. It's very difficult to get them to be productive in July and August. They do not like it. They're from a hot climate. They are not used to these hot nights. From a dry climate, I should say. Let's start that conversation over. They're from a dry climate. It may be hot there, but it's a dry climate. They do not like our hot nights because dry climates don't have these hot nights and they don't have the humidity. And the fruits on bell peppers and poblanos and many other peppers from Mexico really, really have a hard time not only getting producing, but also getting diseases and other things once July gets here. So those you want to start as early as possible. The alternative is don't mess with those. That's what I said. Don't mess with them. We are not Mexico. We are not Texas. We are not New Mexico. We don't do poblanos and anchos really well. What we do are some of the South American Caribbean peppers. We do them really well. But if you're going to start those, if you're going to do those kinds of peppers, start them as early as possible. If you do, they need warm soil. They all need warm soil. They all are going to want warm soil. You need a wall of water to get them started. And I'm going to tell you something else. If you're planting your tomatoes now, and I just bear with me because we're talking about tomato planting, and this is important for a lot of folks, tomatoes and peppers both. Plant them this week if you're along the Gulf Coast. Plant your tomatoes, plant your bell peppers. But make sure the soil stays warm. You don't want to put a mulch on them yet. Keep the mulch away. You want that soil to get as warmed as much by the sunlight as possible. A wall of water, if you've not seen one, is very helpful for planting out this time of year. You won't need it for many days with the tomatoes or the bell peppers, but you could use a wall of water for a couple or 3 weeks now, just to be sure. I'd take it off after a couple of weeks. The other thing that really helps is to have a curtain. Imagine this, a curtain that protects your plants from the north winds. And that is really important. Some people will use a frost cloth if you've got a tomato cage, you know, like a like one of those concrete reinforcing wire tomato cages that are about 5 feet tall. Rusty. You know how they are. And that's what you put over your tomatoes. A lot of people will wrap that whole tomato cage with frost cloth. It makes a ton of difference in heat accumulation on the soil. It allows the heat to dissipate because you're not covering the top. But it allows heat accumulation. It blocks the wind. And you will gain a week or two easily in growth and adaptability by putting that around your plants. If you don't have one of those, just if you've got... if you can just put up a curtain right along the backside of where you planted your tomatoes, stands about 4 or 5 feet tall, that's you know, that doesn't get blown away, that protects those plants from northwest winds, north and northwest winds, it's a huge advantage. It is a huge advantage at this time of year. And then finally, if we have that late frost, which can happen, and we should talk about why stuff happens. And stuff happens more often now than I think it used to, like late frost. If we have that late frost, you're going to need to be able to protect the tomato plant, which is fairly easy. Just find something you can put over the tomato plant, like a big pot, a big container, and then maybe a cloth to put over that to protect those tomatoes on those cold nights. It's that simple. So these are the things to think about. Ooh, let's see. You know, there's another thing to think about, and David Hubble brought it up. You know, your tomato plants may not be big enough yet. If you didn't start them early enough, you may not feel comfortable putting them out. That's okay. That's a good thing. It's a thoughtful thing. It's good, you know. David's tomatoes on the border of being big enough to put out. I think I could feel okay putting them out, and particularly if they had a little bit of protection next week, because it's going to have some nights down into the 40s. But you really want about three ranks of leaves. If you've got three ranks of leaves, you're okay. Not just the seed leaves, but those two or three leaves above it. David's are getting pretty close. But I would say three ranks of leaves would be a good time to put them out. If you're going to buy bell peppers and banana, if you're going to do bell peppers and banana peppers, don't start them from seed now. You're wasting your time. Just go buy the plants. But it's still not too late, as one of our listeners says, not too late. Who is that? I'm gonna look around and see if I can see who that is. It's still not too late for things like ahi dulce and ahi limon, the Scotch bonnet and the fish peppers. They're gonna get started a little later than you might like, but you know what? They'll still produce. You'll be fine. It'll work out. yep, and So Rusty is noticing that things are advancing on spring in a pretty big way. It's a cutworm, looks like there's a cutworm that met its demise. I think that might be a cutworm. Maybe it is an army worm. Maybe it's an army worm. Fiddler crabs are out making their homes for the ladies in about 2 weeks. You know, it's a thing to watch. It is a thing to watch, those fiddler crabs on the coast. And the bluebirds and the other small birds are eating all the holly berries. That's because the holly berries have finally been through enough frost that they're beginning to sweeten up, getting softer, as they often do this time of year. Yeah, you know, it's a lot of good signals. A lot of good signals. We got a caller. We have a caller here. Yeah. Cade, are you there?
Yeah, good morning.
How are you?
I'm great. Living the dream in Mobile, Alabama.
Yeah. So what are you thinking this morning?
Well, I'm thinking we need to be working on them irrigation systems and soil samples, so we can get everything right while we're waiting on them tomato seeds to come up.
Yeah, well, I hope that people not having their tomato seeds just come up, because it'd be too late. So, Kate, tell me about you're doing both is what I'm hearing. Is that right?
Right. That's what I'm doing. I'm going out and, before we get our next rain, while it's not raining in Mobile, getting out there, turning on the controller, seeing what comes on, what doesn't come on, what's broke, what's not broke.
Yeah.
While it's, Sunday. And, just getting the overall look at it, because normally those things are coming on, early in the morning, 5 o'clock, 4, 5, 6 in the morning. And everybody's so busy running around.
Yeah.
Do another thing, Kate, during the week. So,
Kate, and so this is a good opportunity. Have you ever heard me talk about irrigation much? And some of the recommendations?
A little bit. One of the things about grass here in Mobile, where I live anyway, it's real sandy over here on the north side of town. We don't have a lot of water retention, but you get down Midtown, they got too much water retention.
Too much water retention, I agree.
And then you get out West Mobile, there's no water retention. So
yeah,
it just depends on what part of town you're in.
It does, and it also depends on the depth of your soil, and how deep your roots can get. The advantage in West Mobile is that in those soils, because the water table never gets too high, or rarely gets too high, at least if the soil is in good shape, the roots will get pretty deep, so they're still pretty good at it. So I have a recipe, and my recipe is, and I think it's a pretty good recipe. If you can stick your screwdriver down 3 to 6 inches, if it's dry in that first 3 to 6 inches, you need to water. That's a good time to water. If it's wet and still moist up to 3 inches deep, and your lawn is established, you may not need to water. And so that raises some interesting questions when we come back. And we'll come back and talk about it just a little bit.
All right. And the years since I saw you, there's a trunk in the corner. I
keep all my letters, my bills, and demands I keep too. Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Plain Gardening. Cade and I got an interesting discussion. Cade, you still there?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, one of the interesting things, Cade, this is the challenge. And there's a lot of good advice on this. That really, if you can gauge the need for water in the soil, that's the key. And because it does vary depending on where you live. You know, and so if you've got devices that probe deeply, and I know some people who sell irrigation systems do, and say that the irrigation system doesn't come on until it reaches that degree, I think those things are pretty good for lawns. So that's really good. You know, I will say that the watering frequently is one of the greatest, and I'm not the only person, one of the greatest problems that people see in diseases for their lawns. So if you can water only when it's needed, and you have a system that does that, so that's often what we recommend. And I think if you got a lawn irrigation system, it can solve a lot of problems for you, particularly about three or four times a year. It can really make a big difference. So that's one of the things we talk about here. And yeah, it's good. I'm still trying to figure out what's the best irrigation system for a vegetable garden, but that's mostly because they all work pretty much as long as you're thinking about them right. It is probably time, and it's going to be a dry spring. I have a feeling it's going to be a dry spring, so you're probably going to get a bit more business this spring. Kay, we're going to talk about, thanks for calling, and in the next hour, I'm going to talk a little bit about soil tests and how all that works when we come back. So let's save that for the next hour, and we'll talk a little bit about that, and you can call back in if you have some thoughts there, too.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thank you. We could talk a little bit about irrigation, and we're probably going to need to think about it this spring. I have a feeling there's a good chance, looking at the long-range forecast, that we could see drier than normal. How do you deal with that? There's a lot of ways of dealing with it, and, you know, there's a lot of good ways, a lot of easy ways, a lot of smart ways of dealing with irrigation, and we'll talk about that. I think we don't need to talk about this week because we're going to have plenty of rain. but we'll talk about it. We will talk about it soon. I have an image here from, let's see. This is a crepe myrtle. And so the question is, what's the best time to prune and fertilize them? The best time to prune, so I could say there are two answers to that question. What is the best time to prune? The first answer is never. Never prune a crepe myrtle. It's simple. I don't think it's worth your time. I don't think it's worth the crepe myrtle's time. It doesn't help the crepe myrtle one whit, not at all, zero, has no benefits to the crepe myrtle whatsoever. It probably really doesn't even help you a lot. And plus, you have to go out and do it. And if you don't have anything better to do than prune a crepe myrtle, you got a pretty impoverished life. So I'm sorry, but that's the truth. Now, if you are going to prune a crepe myrtle because you don't have anything better to do, the time to do it is summer, after it blooms. Because then you're pruning those, you're pruning those, the small, you're essentially pruning off the fruits so that it doesn't put any energy into producing fruits, and you'll get a better bloom thereafter, in theory. Now, I've done that before, and you know what I found? Nothing. I spent a lot of time pruning a crepe myrtle, with each not pruning anything bigger than a pencil size on the crepe myrtle to get rid of just the fruits, and you know what happened? Nothing. Now, I recognize that nothing ain't everything. I mean, it doesn't tell me that I didn't do it scientifically. But you know, the fact of the matter is, crepe myrtles bloom anyway. And they bloom just fine when nobody ever prunes them. And they probably bloom better when nobody ever prunes them. They're probably less susceptible to diseases when nobody ever prunes them. When should you fertilize them? You know, there are probably two answers to that question. One is never. And most people never prune their never fertilize their crepe myrtles, and their crepe myrtles do just fine. You might get a little more bloom if you fertilize. If you do fertilize, I would recommend doing something like cottonseed meal, which means when can you fertilize? Whenever you feel like it. So the best answer to the fertilization question is never, or whenever you feel like it. How is that? Just when you fertilize, don't use a high-intensity fertilizer. Just use something like cottonseed meal that just kind of works its way in the soil just a little bit. Mulch around that tree as far as you can. That's probably the best thing. Keep that grass away. Don't let the mulch build up on the tree too much, and it'll going to grow like crazy. It'll be fine. Well, it'll be fine, except for the fact that we planted way too many crepe myrtles, and we now have some diseases that are coming around that are just scaring the hootie out of people. I mean, they are ugly-looking diseases. Ugly-looking diseases. What do you do about those? Well, it's tough. Quit planting crepe myrtles. Don't plant so many crepe myrtles. It's just becoming, it's a nursery school. It's everybody, it's an enclosed nursery school in Sheetrock. Everybody is in there, all breathing the same air, and these diseases are spreading really quickly, really fast. So we want to be careful about that. But as far as pruning, as far as fertilizing, I don't see any benefit. Particularly with some nice open-grown crepe myrtles like that, just no benefit at all. Now, I feel like I should have said something else, because I know that the expectation is, but I just am telling you what I know and what I've seen, and it's about as near to the truth as I know to get. Here's a question about spruce trees. Man, this is a classic. Spruce pine, excuse me, and a great pine. It is a beloved pine, and it is. Here is a classic example of what happens when you're not careful about buying plants in containers, and when you're not careful about planting them out. The roots had begun to wrap in the container, I can tell, and they were making a circle around the plant. Now they're girdling the plant, and it's a big problem, isn't it? You know, it might have been planted a little low as well, and the mulch was sitting a little too high. But you can clearly tell that's a container problem. It's just too big. That's a tough one. That is a really tough one. I would definitely cut that largest root. Just cut it. I think the tree is going to survive just fine. And each year I might go in and cut one of those. It means you're going to have to come back slowly. Cut that biggest root this year, because it is going to be a problem. I can tell. And each year cut one additional root to allow it to get established. Or cut the big root now. Come back in this fall and cut the next biggest root. That's starting to wrap. So what we've got are five or six roots that just look like swirling around the plant. Ooh, that's a problem. Call me if that doesn't make any sense, but I think we're going to have to do, Joseph, we're going to have to do some work on that. Hey, we got a lot to talk about. We're coming back.
Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. You know, is this tomato day? Is this tomato day? I think it is, in a way. For many people, it is tomato day. If you're in the warmer parts, and the places that stay warm, the places where the nights stay particularly warm and muggy in July, particularly around Mobile Bay, like Mobile, particularly Midtown, Downtown, Fairhope, Fowl River, Gulf Shores, Dolphin Island, those places, I think this is tomato days for those places. It's time to get them out. If you're a little farther west, If you're a little farther away from the bay, if you're a little farther away from the water, that's as important as anything, maybe more important than being north. If you're in Georgetown, Jim, I don't know. I might take Jim's advice about when to plant in Georgetown. But I think I could afford to wait a week there, a week or two. Citronelle, you definitely want to wait a week or two. No need to rush it there. No need to rush it there unless you've got some special protective devices. If you got some protective devices, you can do okay. Like a wall of water. So for a lot of people, it's already tomato day. And if your tomatoes are ready to go out, it's tomato day. You know, it might as well be. They need a little protection. I told you a little bit about that earlier. If you didn't hear me, we'll repeat it for you. You call me and talk about it. What do we do for protections? Walls of water are really nice. They can help for the next 2 or 3 weeks. If you don't know what a wall of water is, go on your little smartphone and punch it in and see what comes up. You'll see. Works really well. If you don't want to use a wall of water, and that's okay too, it's nice to have a screen around your tomato. They may be as effective, practically speaking, as a wall of water. And you can protect them on if the night happens to get really cold. I think that sometimes just having a cloth screen that you can see through, like a frost cloth, it works really well. Sometimes plastic works well, too. You can just put a plastic screen behind your plant. Don't make it too hot, because plastic can get a little bit hot. Clear plastic can get a little bit hot. That can work okay. Don't cover the top with it. It will get too hot. And then we got to talk about, well, what kind of tomato cage? Because that's a question we're getting a lot about right now. And so what is those? You know, everybody's got a fancy name for these tomato cages that you buy. Ultimato, was that the name of the cage? You know, none of them are really big enough to handle the growth of a well-grown tomato here. And the ones you get at Walmart, Home Depot, they were designed for somebody in Nebraska, I guess, or Alaska or somewhere, where tomatoes don't get very big. They just don't work. I mean, your tomato is going to overgrow those cages very quickly. In fact, if you grow your tomatoes well, they're going to overgrow. They're going to get to the top of and spill over the top of any tomato cage you put up. But you want to give them a little bit of room. That's okay. They'll come back down. It'll be fine when they start clambering down. But I would say a tomato cage that's about 5 feet tall is about right. And the advantage of 5 feet tall is pretty simple. You can reach it. You know, I could say, well, you need a tomato cage that's 8 feet tall, but you ain't going to be able to reach those tomatoes. So a tomato cage that's about 5 feet tall, that's why reinforcing wire works pretty well. I build my tomato cages out of limbs, out of bamboo, whatever I can find. I make a teepee-like device, works pretty well, put string around it, works really great. There's a lot of different ways of doing it. You can put those stakes in the ground. You know, I would love to talk about the techniques and the technical aspects of building a tomato cage, but I don't want to make it seem too hard. You just do it. You get some limbs that are pretty sturdy. You poke them, you trim the edges off so they're easy to poke in the ground. That's one way of doing it. You can lean them over towards the top. If you lean them over towards the top, they ought to meet about 7 feet, 6.5 feet. Let's make it 6.5 feet above the ground. And that'll give just enough space for that tomato to grow up, and it'll start spilling out. There's other ways of doing it. That's kind of a teepee version. You can also make a trellis, which they grow on. I've done that before. That's great, too. But you want something, something cage-like. If you have to do a lot of pruning, it's annoying. They grow too fast. It reduces your tomato yields. I don't see any big advantage to doing a lot of pruning on tomatoes. You really don't want to do it if you can help it. A cage is a good way to go. But use a reinforcing wire cage. That's another thing. Build your own cage. Talk to me about how to build it. I love talking about stuff like that. Irby, you still there? Erbia in Foley.
Yes, sir.
You there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, what it is, I've got, every year I have to transplant grass, you know, or either bring in sod and put in my yard in different spots. I put in some lime pellets. Will that help it a lot, or will that hurt it?
It won't make that much difference, because that's probably not where the problem is, but it won't hurt.
What can I do for my lawn?
Yeah, so give the roots room to grow. And that is probably the major issue. So once you lose grass in a place, the soil there gets very compacted, and it's probably compacted several inches down. Here's a key, particularly in areas where you've got a lot of browning out. Now it could be other things, complicating it, but it's probably mostly the fact that the soil is compacted. That's going to be the first thing. So what you want to do is, I'm going to give you three steps. First thing is, take a fork, a garden fork that has four tines, and poke it into the soil. Is just wiggle it into the soil as far as you can, and then lean back and crack it. Don't turn it upside down, just crack it. And that's root run. That'll give your roots room to run. It'll break up the hard pan. I guarantee you there's a hard pan under there. And that's and it will make all the difference in how roots function. I'm going to give you a four-step plan. Second plan is, tell me what kind of grass you're growing.
Centipede.
Yeah. Second plan is, do something besides centipede. Centipede has more problems on the coast than any other grass. There's no grass that's perfect. They all have problems, but centipede is like, if you had to pick the perfect grass to never grow on the Gulf Coast, it would be centipede. Uh-huh. And centipede is always going to die out. Why do people plant centipede? Because it's cheap. And it acts like it's cheap. And that means you spend a fortune keeping it up. So use something else. Try St. Augustine there and see if that doesn't do a little better after you crack it. The third thing I'm going to tell you is, wait until fall to plant. This is a terrible time to plant. You want to plant these new lawns in fall. They take much better. You can even plant them into early January. But you're getting towards the time when it's going to be very hard for those roots to penetrate before we get our drought. And so you can try it now, but you'll know that you'll do better if you do in fall. So always do this patch in fall. And here's a fourth thing. I may have gone over my limit already, but never mind. I can't count. So here's the other thing I want you to think about. When you redo this, you probably need to add a little bit of organic matter. So if they're big brown patches and you're having to patch them in, spend a little bit extra time. Crack your soil, then put some pine bark, each piece no bigger than your fingernail, about 2 inches deep, where you're going to put that sod. Now, you don't want it to be a big mound, but just add a little bit of that pine bark. You don't have to dig it in, and just put your sod right on top of it. I have to take a break. I hope I gave you enough to go with. Did I?
Yes, you did.
All right. Hey, call me back if you got any more questions about that. Yes, sir. We're going to be back.
Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played. Waiting for the Alabama sun to go down to the red dirt girls in a red dirt town, me and Lillian.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Okay. So, potato leaf tomatoes. There's a lot of tomato varieties out there. And they do many different things. We've been taking tomatoes all around the world. It's odd that a plant well adapted to hot, cool summer to dry, cool summer conditions in Mexico, at least cool nights, has become the thing around the world. One of the reasons why, you know, just thinking about tomatoes, one of the reasons tomatoes became such a part of Italian culture was Italy is very much like the mountains of Mexico in terms of its climate. And so they grew very well there, and the rest of the country had, and the rest of the world had to try to do the same thing. It's interesting. Tomatoes all around. There's a thing called a potato leaf tomato. Does it make any difference? Because the leaves don't have the lobing. It doesn't have the little indentions, fringes, that are different than on a regular tomato. Does it make any difference whether a potato? I don't think it does. But some are that way. It's just a variety. It would be an interesting study to see whether there is any consistent advantage to potato leaf over regular. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. But there it is. You got a potato leaf tomato. If it doesn't have any lobes, probably doesn't make any difference. There are other things that'll make a lot more difference as time goes on. What am I missing here? Have I missed anybody? Oh yeah. So Wayne, listen, so now that I see the leaves up close, and a little better with a little better photography, thank you for that good photography. I can tell you that middle plant is probably a red bay. Very nice plant, very cool plant. Let's call that a red bay. I'm almost certain that is a red bay now that I can see it better. Red bay. It's a native plant, not a magnolia, related to avocados of all things, has a disease that we have decided to spread through the South that is wiping it out. But red bay is the bay leaf we used in traditional Gulf Coast cooking. Red bay is what you're looking at, Wayne. Hope you saw that. Sam, I'm sorry I missed your question on soil testers. We're going to come back to that. I think it's an important one. We raised the issue today. And we'll come back to it. Catherine, you there?
Hey, Bill.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing good.
I have a question about Spanish bluebells. I planted some, about 6 or 8 of them, about 5 years ago, and they need to be moved. I mean, spread separated and it started over. And last year I called you when they had already bloomed and talked about moving them, and you said not to move them then, that I would cut off their food supply. So now, of course, I didn't do it later, and now they're about 4 inches up from the ground. I wonder if I could move them now or if that would be a mistake.
Catherine, you're going to not like me when this is all over with. But you got to call me at a different time of year. So wait for that foliage. Wait for the foliage to die down. Okay? Wait for the foliage to die down. If the foliage is up, it's got plenty of roots. The roots are doing all their activity. It's not a great time. Mark where those guys are. You know where they are. You've been worried about them for a long time now. You know exactly where they are.
Right.
And when the foliage begins to wither, which is going to be apparently a little later than it was the last time you called me about this, wait until that foliage withers and then move them. Because once the foliage withers, the roots are going to wither too. And that means it's just a bulb, and they won't even know you've moved them. You don't scream when you move them. Don't shout too loud. Don't talk too loud. Just quietly go and move them once those roots wither and once the foliage withers. With bluebells, that's probably going to be, because they bloom a little later than other things. But it's going to be second week in May. They'll be ready to move, I expect. And even the first week of May, if there's a little bit of foliage left, they'll have plenty of time to photosynthesize and they'll be okay to move. But you know, sometime around the first of May, second week of May, is about the time to move them.
Okay. All right. I'll plan on doing that then.
All right. If they're not withered by the first or second week in May, you call me and we'll figure out what to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Bill.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, so, you know, maybe I should talk about what David wants to talk about, because it's a good question. Seeing the Carolina jasmine starting to bloom, you know, there are a couple of varieties of Carolina jasmine out there, but they do start blooming early. Oftentimes, in a warm year, it's a measure of how it's been a chilly winter. And it's going to be good for a lot of fruit trees. A lot of people who've had some problems with fruit trees, some of the temperate fruit trees like peaches and other things not blooming well. It's going to get a good bloom this year. But the Carolina jasmine usually starts in February, and it's rare that it's this late. There are a couple of species. One is earlier than the other. One is basically a midwinter or early winter bloomer, and the other is tends to bloom afterwards into early spring. But there it is. Vanna, I'm listening. Let's talk about milkweed for a second.
Yes, I didn't want to interrupt your good tomato advice in the first time.
Yes, it's important, that tomato
now,
advice.
If you don't mind, if you could let me know the correct variety of milkweed for our area to attract the monarch butterflies. I don't want to plant the wrong one. And plus that, I read that it takes a couple years to get those plants really established. And even if the nursery has one that's already up, the article said they don't transplant well. So I don't know.
Yeah, all that's kind of true. Let me tell you the best variety for where you are on the Gulf Coast. And if you've got very sandy, sharply drained sandy soils, almost dune-like soils around Gulf Shores, it's perfect for you. It is the perfect milkweed for monarchs on the Gulf Coast. It's Asclepias humistrata. And what humistrata? So humistrata, and goodness gracious, I gotta look up the common name of that, don't I?
Well, what's the first part? I can spell pretty well. Just pronounce the first part again.
Well, all milkweeds are in the genus Asclepias, named for an
okay,
old
yeah.
guy named yeah Asclepias.
Yes, I got
and
it.
And the second part is humistrata. Okay. H-U-M-I-S-T-R-A-T-A, as in almost like it's starting out humid, except you add humistrata. Pine Woods milkweed, it's the very best. If you can find anybody growing it, it is the absolute best. What we know is that milkweed was used by monarchs on the Gulf Coast probably as much or more than any other milkweed. And it was hugely important. The loss of the longleaf pine ecosystem and humistrata meant that we lost a lot of monarchs on the Gulf Coast. So if you can find that one, that is the one. So see if there's not somebody selling seeds or maybe somebody growing it out. We will. I'm going to look, since you made me think about it. And since we've talked about it and gotten everybody all stirred up, I'm going to see what I can do about finding some plants of Asclepias humistrata. Maybe we can get them to the botanical gardens.
For the sale. Oh, that would be
for the
excellent sale.
So let's just see. That's not a guarantee. I'm going to think about it. I'm going to work on it. Because it's a good one. It really is just It blows everything else out of the water. There's some that work kind of well and some that won't grow well here, et cetera, but humistrata is the tops.
Oh, thank you so, so much.
Yes, and now it's on me to find you some.
Well, I'll get them. Thank you so, so much. All right.
Thank you, Vanna.
Bye.
Yeah, and I'll tell you, Asclepias humistrata is one cool-looking plant. I mean, it is so cool-looking. Sandhill milkweed, Pine Woods milkweed, got a lot of different names. The leaves, you don't even have to see it bloom. The leaves, and it's the leaves that the monarchs are after. We could talk about this for a while. But we got to take a break.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Uh-huh. All right. Here we are back. You know what? This has been fun. You get to talk about fun things sometimes, like, well, not just tomatoes, which are fun. It's fun to think about them, fun to think about how to make them work here. We've done a lot of that. For a lot of you, it's about time to plant if your tomatoes are the right size. If you're not going to able to plant this week, those of you along the Gulf Coast should think very seriously about planting next week. And I mean by that, I mean people who are particularly close to the bay. If you're a little farther inland, you can wait a while. Lots of ins and outs there, but there you go. Carol, how many questions did you ask me this morning? That's all right. You don't have a quota. You can ask as many questions as you like. I just have to keep up with them all. So Carol, I think all of them are just fine. I don't see a little out of focus. One of those pictures of azaleas. She sent me pictures of azaleas, said some of them have stubby growth, and I can't quite see this. But I think that what you're seeing is that you have an azalea that is an encore, and it has a slightly different heritage than some of the others. I'm guessing it's an encore by the hairy stems, which means that it has as a parent one of the nearly tropical azaleas. And but it looks fine. I think it's okay. There's not a problem with it. It's just a different heritage than some of your other azaleas, is my suspicion. And that's what's going on there. I'd say the picture is a little fuzzy, but I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, I'm pretty sure that it's okay. It's doing just fine. And I think that may be my best bet is looking at the leaves, looking at the hairiness of the stem. That's probably one of the encores, which has a different heritage. She also sent me a picture of holes at the base of her longleaf made by, more than likely, how do I say this politely, mice or rats. I can't tell what. I think possibly cotton rats. Which are a native rat. Don't let the word rat scare you too much. Is this going to damage the pine? No. Longleaf are really good at dealing with that kind of stuff. It will definitely, they'll definitely dig up smaller plants. That can be a problem around smaller plants. It's not going to hurt the pine. The pine is part of an ecosystem where there are lots of little hole diggers. They're part of the ecosystem, and in many ways that longleaf encourages those little leaf hole diggers. It aids in infiltration of water, longleaf roots are set up that it pretty well ignores all that, doesn't undermine the tree in any way. I think you're okay. Where the pine is concerned, if the fact that you have RATS bothers you in some way, well, we can talk about that. Because I think that's what it is. If you're feeding the dogs nearby or feeding cats outside, that could explain what's going on there. We can try to diagnose why you have them, but they're not hurting the pine. They're not hurting the pine. We can come back and talk about that some more. Glenn sent me a picture of a plum. Boy, it's got, yeah, you don't need all that stuff coming out of the base there. Glenn, plums aren't the best adapted trees for the immediate Gulf Coast. That red plum is going to have lots of problems. But those stems coming up from the base, yeah, you don't need them. Now, Let me tell you, they're also very the plum looks like it's planted a little bit too deeply. I will tell you that. If you can pull it up out of the ground just a little bit, if you haven't had it set there too long, remove that string around the trunk. It will cause problems. But yes, you do need to prune those off. Now, there's a couple of ways of doing it. And at this stage, there's a lot of things going on and a lot of things going wrong on that plum tree. And plums are very sensitive. I might cut all of those back by half and then come back later when the tree has gotten a little more diameter and prune them back a little more closely. But don't prune any of them too close to the trunk. Prune them all back by half, even up to about 2 feet. Let me see if I'm right on that. Yeah, up to about 2 feet, you can just prune them all back by half. The ones closest to the ground, you can prune back by two-thirds. Let the tree develop a little bit of size, then finish that pruning up so that you don't leave big wounds, because they are an open invitation to borers, and borers are a big problem on plum trees. I hope that helped. Does that make sense, Glenn? You don't need those limbs and the bottom 2 feet, but you don't want to make big holes in your trunk either. So there it is. I think you're okay, Carol, but we might want to think about what's going on, why you have so many, why they've decided to colonize that area. Ed, you still there? Ed.
Yeah, I'm here.
Tell me what's going on with that Satsuma.
Well, it's the second year, and the first year something has eaten the leaves right off of it, and it never did produce anything. And this year it's starting again.
It's starting again, something eating the leaves off. And they're starting to eat the leaves off right now?
Yeah. There's leaves all over the ground. All you do is touch it and they fall off.
Ah. So, yes, and these are mature leaves?
Yeah, they're nice and green, and they're fully matured.
Yeah. So, I don't think anything's eating the leaves. I think the leaves are, the tree is shedding its leaves. And it's shedding its leaves for a lot of reasons, and I can't tell you which one. If it remains generally healthy and it only loses leaves this time of year, I guarantee it's not a bug. It could be winter damage, but it could be winter damage. So you could have had this cold spell may have done a number on those leaves. So we had a cold spell.
Yeah.
Where are you, Ed? You're in Midtown. You're in Westmobile.
Westmobile.
Yeah. It got down to what? Ooh, it got cold. It was down like 17, 18, 19 degrees in places.
Right.
In Westmobile, that's enough to do a little bit of damage to leaves on the citrus. And so the citrus is probably dropping some of its leaves because of the cold. Sometimes it'll drop leaves in spring because it just sheds leaves, just normally, like any tree will shed leaves as the new leaves comes on. But I suspect that is because of the cold that you're losing some leaves. What can you do to stop that? Nothing. You kind of wait on it. Yeah, wait for warm weather, and it'll put on some new leaves. But I don't think anything's eating them. I think that's just some reaction to the cold that probably was a little bit much for some of those leaves. What percentage of leaves do you think you're losing?
Probably 20%, 30%. Not a whole lot.
Yeah. Not a problem. Yeah. I think you'll be fine. I think it'll recover nicely. Let's wait on it. You might have lost some flower buds, so don't be surprised if we lost some flower buds this year with that kind of cold occurring when it did. And we might have lost some flower buds, so you might not get a lot of flowers this year. Or the flowers may only show up on one side of the tree. Let's wait on it. It's fine. Nothing's eating those leaves. You're good.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, all right, Ed. Good to hear from you. Yeah, you know, I guess I should warn folks about that. We probably will see some citrus damage from that cold. I don't think it's going to be terrible bad, but it's out there. So Jim has sent me a picture, and I'll get to use the name. We used it the other day with someone else. It's a Corydalis, yellow fumitory. Fumitory is one name you often see a lot for that group of plants. Jim in Georgetown. Pretty sure that's a non-native fumitory. Fumitory. It's kind of nice because the Latin name, I think, used to be Fumitoria, which means that if I remember the common name, it wasn't hard to remember the Latin name. But it's one of the fumitories. I'll have to see what I can't remember what the Latin name is now, but Fumitory. That one, that's not ramping fumitory. It's one of the yellow ones. Maybe we could call it Corydalis was the old name for it. Yeah. And so there it is. Does that help? That'll give you a good start, Jim. I may be able to look over the break here and give you exactly the species on that one. But fumitory, that'll get you a good start in case I'm not, see if you can beat me to it to tell me which one it is. Fumitory is, and you can look them up. There's a bunch of them. Most of them are from Europe and Asia. There's a couple of natives, but they're very rare in our part of the world, down on the, at least on the Gulf Coast. They're pretty common in North Alabama. So Jim also tells me that the material worries are just fine, but the year-olds lost most of their leaves, which is typical. Jim thinks they're going to be okay, and I think Jim's probably right. He's been looking at this kind of stuff for a long time and thinking about it. Who have I missed today? If I've missed your questions, you let me know, and I will try to come back and get to them. Because we got about 15 minutes coming up after this break, which is, we're going to hear that music starting any second now. And we'll try to get to those questions as soon as we can and deal with them. Oh, you know, we didn't answer that question. We're going to talk about soil tests. We got to talk about soil tests. Don't let me forget to talk about that. Foxglove, is it safe to plant a foxglove out? You betcha. Foxgloves love it cold. They hate it hot. Best time to plant foxglove is in fall, but you don't want to delay any more. Foxglove hates it hot, loves it cold. We're going to be back.
Hide the deadly black tarantula.
Daylight come and we want go home.
If
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch. Daylight come.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, we're coming back. I was going to try to beat Jim to the question of which kind of fume wort he's got. I'm not quite there. I'm thinking about it, Jim. And we may have to come back to that next week, but it's definitely one of the fume worts. Fumarias, fumitories, they're called. I got to figure out which one it is, but we'll not occupy the rest of you while I'm doing that. Hey, we said we were going to talk about soil tests. And Cade raised the issue. It's a good one, and I want to talk about it just a little bit. Most of the problems with our soils are not the result, are not something that soil tests are good at testing for. And the folks at Auburn one day wrote me a nice email and said, you know, you're right. We're trying to develop a new soil test that is better, that tells us a lot more about the quality of a soil. Sometimes a soil test, the conventional soil tests that people use are that are cheap, are good at telling you how bad your soil is sometimes, but not why it's bad and not how to fix it. So do I think you need a soil test? You know, I don't ever use soil tests. I'll be honest. There are times when I wish I did have a really good soil test. But one of the issues is if you've prepared your soil and it's really good soil, soil tests don't work. They don't work very well. And it's because organic matter and all the things that are natural part of soil, they mess up soil tests. So soil tests are really for disaster soils. For soils that are already such a disaster that for the most part, what you really need is organic matter, which serves as a platform for a lot of things in terms of chemistry that obviates the need for a conventional soil test. Auburn has a more sophisticated soil test. It's a little more complicated about when it's available. I have not been able to get good information about it lately. I'm going to go and look it up and try to pester folks at Auburn about it to see when it is, to see how to make it work. But it's a little better at telling you what you need for your soil. So am I going to tell you need to go out and do the first thing you need to do is get a soil test? No, I'm not going to tell you that. Unless you really spend money and get a pretty good one. And that's a little bit more complicated. But the typical soil test ain't going to help you a whole lot. You call me next week and we're going to talk about why that is and why it's a problem. Carol, you've got some creatures in your yard. It could be, if you're up at Bay Minette, there's a possibility it could be chipmunks. You know, if you're seeing chipmunks, that's useful to know. I don't think it's a threat to either your, I don't think it's a threat to either the longleaf or the oak for a lot of reasons. But, you know, you do have something that's digging, and they're pretty active. It could be chipmunks. Could be a hispid cotton rat, which are not such bad creatures after all. But they can be annoying, and sometimes they can concentrate in large numbers. If you're feeding animals nearby, they'll be eating, and that'll even birds. And that can allow them to develop in large numbers and cause a little bit of a problem. So one thing to think about. Hey, we started out by thinking about tomatoes. and I think for a lot of you, this is a good time to think about getting your tomatoes out. The tomatoes need to have, three ranks of leaves above the seed leaves. The seed leaves are those little leaves at the bottom that don't really have any indentations on them. The bigger leaves that are up top, you want about three ranks of those before you put a plant out. And I think for many of you who are very close to the coast, this is a very good time to do it. If you're up on the hill, if you're above the Midtown, I'd say you could wait a week or two, and you'd probably be okay because your nights don't get quite as oppressive as soon as they do on the in the lower areas, but they're still going to be, you still want to get them out as soon as possible. If you put your tomatoes out, can we say this again? If you put your tomatoes out, you need to think about what you're going to do to protect them. And how you protect them depends on what you got for them to climb on. If you've got if you're going to go ahead and put a tomato cage around them that's made out of reinforcing wire, you know, one of the neat things you can do is even take clear plastic or even dark plastic, it doesn't matter. But clear plastic's probably a little better, and put it on the back side of that tomato cage so that it blocks the plant from getting too much wind. That'll definitely help those little tomato plants. Helps a tremendous amount. Even better is to take, if you've got some frost cloth, which is that spun bond polyester cloth that looks like shears, looks kind of like shears. You can see through it. There's lots of light transmission. It's getting a lot easier to find nowadays. Wrap your tomato cage with that. It's really good. It allows the light to shine through. They'll get plenty of light, but they won't get the drying winds, and they'll have a chance to breathe, and that really helps. That's almost like adding a week or two to the tomato season when you do that. If you do a wall of water, you can add 2 or 3 weeks to the tomato season. Just don't leave it on too long. If you leave it on too long, you're going to delay flowering, and you'll have some problems. But a wall of water, it really makes these early tomatoes really snug, and you don't have to worry too much about them. So the shears, the cloth, the protective screen that's on that north or northwest side of your tomato plant, that's very important. Here's another thing that you need to think about when you put your tomatoes out. We need to get the tomatoes out as soon as possible because temperatures are going to be too hot in summer, so we got to do it. But there is still a 50% chance of late frost for most folks. And those late frosts seem to be coming later and later. And there's not a lot we can do about it, except stopping the frost. But we can prevent the frost from causing damage to the plant, and that's very easy. So when you put your tomato out, think, I got to cover these in case it gets cold. What am I going to do it with? And here's a simple way to do it. Here's a simple recipe. There's a bunch of simple recipes. Find a black plastic pot that's bigger than your tomato plant when it grows, you know, over several days, maybe a 7-gallon pot. Find it, get it ready to put out, and then find something to cover that pot, like a cloth or a small blanket or a towel or something, good beach towel, anything that helps to hold the temperature in and holds that soil temperature in, and that'll help you on those cold nights, help you a lot, even if you don't have a wall of water. Don't want to make it sound complicated. It's really easy to protect those tomato plants from cold nights. It takes a little bit more than just a black plastic pot by itself, but it doesn't take much more. And you'll have them ready to go. Hey, call me back next week. Jeff, call me back next week. We'll talk a little bit more about your grape arbors. We gotta go, folks, but it was good to talk to you.
If it keeps on raining, levee's going to break.